Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is David Bray, Chief Information Officer with the Federal Communications Commission. So, David, you've mentioned a little bit about your technology and innovation strategy, but I'd like to delve a little bit more into it. Could you give us a sense of your strategic priorities going forward?
Sure. We actually do have seven strategic priorities that we actually have blogged about with three measurable mission goals. And really, that came about of discussions with the 18 different bureaus and offices, as well as with the chairman's office. And one of the first things I did when I arrived was I actually purchased food on my own and said, I'm going to just have an open lunch hour from 11:30 to 1:30. Food's going to be provided. If you want to come and just share ideas. And we did it again recently as we actually sort of began to share what we're moving forward on. Again, sort of paid for coffee and donuts and just had the commission meeting room and just had people come. Because I think people, while they may initially come from the food, conversations strike up and you'll learn things that you wouldn't know otherwise through formal meetings. And so our seven priorities are really focused on, one, prior to my arrival, the FCC apparently didn't really have a really good way to telecommute, which is kind of ironic since we are the Federal Communications Commission. And so with speed, we actually, when I initially went to the team and said, how quickly can we roll out virtual desktop? They said, well, that might take 9 to 12 months. I was like, can we condense it to like one third that? And to their credit, within a very short time, they had done a pilot with our Gettysburg facility and rolled it out 100% there. We're now more than 50% of the offices here at FCC. And so we hope to have concluded in another month and a half that finished. But it took them all of probably about from concept to rollout less than 5.5 months. It was great to see with speed that they could actually move forward with that. There were some learning experiences along the way. The moment of both happiness and horror for any CIO is when you demo something and the chairman says, I want to be in the beta. And you're like, oh. But to his credit, he was in the beta. He helped provide valuable feedback. We learned from it and we moved forward from it. But that's when you know you have an interesting boss when he wants to be in the beta himself. So you're like, the second priority that we're also looking at is how can we actually begin to improve our cybersecurity posture? Again, with 207 systems, with more than 40% of them more than 10 years old, that's obviously something that's of concern. And that it, through no fault of our own, they may have been engineered well to begin with, but those are aging technologies. And so we're looking at ways that we can actually secure that and move forward with that as well. And then the third thing we're trying to do is, again, with the by doing the storyboards, we can begin to identify modules that we can reuse. So a bureau might draw out this workflow of how they might actually do complaint reform, or they might do rulemaking, or they may do licensing. And as they do that, we may actually step back and say, well, look, it looks like a lot of commonality in some of these workflows. One, they got to authenticate the user. I would love to actually have a common way of authenticating the user as opposed to having 207 different ways of authenticating the user. Or export to PDF, or import from this type of database, or provide this export. And so we're moving towards the ability to actually reuse module parts of our architecture internally, but then also expose that through application protocol interfaces, so application programming interfaces, APIs. And by having the APIs exposed, that actually allows us to actually begin to remix also what's available on the outside with our partners, with the public. We actually do have exposed for several of our commission systems already. We've already sort of begun to expose APIs that you can use to pull down commenting on rules, things such as that. The national broadband map, there's some things that you can pull down as well. And so I really see that the future of what the FCC becomes in terms of IT is it's more of a data broker. Both in terms of receiving data from the public and our partners, but then also providing it out and sort of serving as that trusted broker on data.
Yeah, so you had mentioned in our previous segment a little bit, you touched on or sort of teed up your IT modernization effort. I'd like you to pursue that a little bit more. And maybe how does the creation of a choice architecture decision-making process factor into this? And could you tell us a little bit more?
Sure. I could, as CIO, issue a memo and sort of say, you know, we're going to start doing these top-down edicts. We're going to argue that, you know, it's more cost-effective to move towards network printers as opposed to local printers. But, you know, I've seen that tried. And it doesn't really work too well. And so what I tried to do when I first arrived was I said, can we get normalized cost estimates as how much it costs to provide a local printer versus a network printer? Can we get cost estimates as how much it provides for different tablets versus desktops? And so we can begin to provide a menu of choices to the bureaus and offices. And so they can choose and say, you know, in my circumstance, I'm okay with network printers because we're all in the same location. It makes sense. Or maybe I'm in the field and I actually do need that local printer because the reality is it's only three of us and, you know, we're out in the field. But they can choose that. The same is true with as we move forward with modernizing. I mean, I fully expect that probably in about 2 or 3 years from now, we may or may not do another refresh of our desktops. Mm-hmm. We may be moving more to laptops and tablets. And so, again, providing them that choice, virtual desktop allows them to work wherever they want to work, on any device that they want to work, and sort of exploring that flexibility. But the other thing is also thinking about when we actually sort of map out those workflows. I'm sure it's not a surprise to any CIO when you hear that everyone says that their system is different, and here's why. And that's partly why I go back to the storyboard, which is, okay, well, you can be in the driver's seat for how you actually want to change your business. The other thing with storyboards that's also useful is oftentimes people approach it as if the way they solved the problem last year, or in some respects 10 years ago. And they say, well, you know, it used to be a paper-based process where we mailed out the forms, we got the forms back, we scanned them, then we actually dealt with them. And while we're still thinking about using the web, we're going to use the same process. And you're like, well, maybe there's some shortcuts you can do now. And so by storyboarding, it puts them in the driver's seat, it gets them to buy into it. And then we can say to them, well, if you reuse these modules we've already written for these other bureau efforts, you'll get it in half the time at a cheaper price, but it's up to you because you may be able to say, well, no, this module really is unique and here's why. And it's like, okay, that's your choice, but it's going to either take a longer period of time and it may also cost more money. But it's me as the CIO being that broker to that conversation versus assuming that I know exactly what's right for the 207 different systems, which I don't have the number of hours in the days to do that, but actually allowing the bureau and offices to actually have the autonomy to actually figure out what's best for them.
But I was just wondering, you had mentioned a little bit about the entrepreneurs, correct? And I'd like to switch gears there and go, the innovation aspect of that. Some folks may mention it's a customer service-oriented approach, but I think it when I was researching for this, it seems a little bit more than that. And could you tell us a little bit more about this initiative? How are you empowering these folks to work with the bureaus and offices to get their IT needs done within a limited budget? And more importantly, what prompted you to go in this direction?
So maybe I'll start with the second part of your question first, which is how did I sort of get that position? Back in 2004, I had been IT chief for the Bioterrorism Preparedness Response Program. And with the Bioterrorism Preparedness Response Program, I actually started within 2000. There was always a tension between the enterprise view of the Centers for Disease Control and the needs of the program. And in the enterprise view, obviously, wanted to do a waterfall approach. They had a 3 to 5 year plan. And I used to, and somewhat tongue in cheek, I used to say, well, we don't have an agreement with the bioterrorists not to strike until we're done with our IT systems. You know, they will not operate on that timetable. And so I at least had experienced that. And then later in 2004, I got offered the opportunity to also be director of informatics for HIV/AIDS at the Centers for Disease Control, and that was the division of HIV/AIDS, which had historically 10 different branches that also had not really worked together well. There was not a good enterprise view. And I was given the choice between do I create my own IT shop that then works with them? And I said, well, no, actually, I'd prefer to embed them. Partly because I just figured if it's another shop, it's going to become another silo. I'm a big believer, if you look at history, the thing that's great about the United States is we had fought a revolution and that the Federalist Papers number 51 said they wanted ambition to counter ambition. That was going to be the checks and balances. And so I think actually, people lament that bureaucracy somehow is slow or has cylinders of excellence or silos. That's actually intentional. It prevents any one person from getting too much power. But that said, if you want to actually move forward and make change, if you yourself become a cylinder, it's not going to work. And so you got to do a network model, which is great. It's actually what CIOs should be doing because we get networks, but oftentimes we forget the human network aspect and the value of face-to-face. And so I went in this direction when I arrived at this. So I did that at the Division of HIV/AIDS in 2004. It was interesting. 8 of the bureaus and offices bought into it. 2 of them were kind of resistant. In fact, they were very vocal of, well, we'd prefer to have epidemiologists. Why are you giving us an IT person? I'm like, you'll get your epidemiologist, but we need to have an IT person that's working with you to understand the context in which you operate, sort of translate. And actually, some of the people I ended up hiring were actually anthropologists and sort of embedding in the bureau and office. It got to be so interesting because, of course, in government, there's some interesting personalities. Someone actually did a Freedom of Information Act, a FOIA request on my resume because they didn't think I was old enough to be qualified for the job I was in. I was like, no problem. Here's my resume. That's fine. But a year into it, actually, one of the biggest resistors came back later and said this was the best thing that ever happened to their branch. And so that to me actually showed that while there was resistance, once you get over that hump, then it was actually accepted. And so I think that's, again, the role of leader is sometimes you're going to step outside of expectations. You got to manage that friction. So when I arrived at the FCC and saw sort of the same situation of 18 different bureaus and offices that hadn't been used to working together as an enterprise, to be honest, it may have been the case where whoever shouted the loudest got what they wanted, I knew I had to do something different. And also I wanted to empower. I intentionally did want to empower the bureaus and offices because I didn't have, with 35 people, enough people to actually understand the whole breadth of the 207 different systems. And so by going this path of having entrepreneurs, it was a way of having the bureaus and offices have buy-in and actually have, you know, the direction to shape where they wanted to go. But it was also when I wanted to try and hire people, I could actually tout that I will give you autonomy. I want talented people. It doesn't have to always be chain of command. You can actually try new things out because I'm a big believer that there's really three things that will make someone work for something regardless of how much you actually are paid. And those three things being, one, if you give them a sense of autonomy. Two, if you give them the ability to see measurable progress on whatever they're working on. And then the third thing, and this is something we have in spades in public service, hard missions that are important. And that's just another purpose. And so it's sort of a rallying call. And it's also a chance to actually sort of step back, have talented people. You know, I'm a big believer that A people hire A people. If you have A people, set them forth and see what they can do. Give them boundary conditions. And then, you know, say if you hit against this boundary, come back to me and we can have a conversation and figure whether or not we expand that boundary or if we stay in it. But otherwise, it's up to you as to how you want to get from point A to point F, and you can figure out A, B, C, D, E, F. That was a bit of a shift, though, for the team because they initially wanted me to give them, you know, explicit guidance. And I was like, that's not what I should be doing as chief information officer. I mean, if I'm laying out the specifics of code, I mean, I could do that. I used to do that. I'm just an overpaid programmer. Same thing with other things as well. And that it also helps the team remind themselves as to what's really important is being creative problem solvers to the mission. And so that creates a sense of energy because they do actually work across the entire FCC and it creates a sense of smile. I mean, we're building relationships and to me that's really fun when you get out of bed and you actually just realize you now have people that actually are they see basically anything is possible with how we get out of having these 207 different systems that are very old and that no idea is too crazy to consider.
I'd like to explore a little bit your efforts to facilitate and improve secure employee telework and mobility at FCC. What are you doing in this area? And you had mentioned briefly the virtual desktop infrastructure effort. As you pursue that and expand it, how does that lead to a bring your own device policy?
Right. So with the Federal Communications Commission, again, not having the ability to telework well gave us an opportunity that we could actually sort of fill that void with speed. And so with virtual desktop, we rolled out a VMware product. And so that allows your desktop to show up on your desktop at work, but you could also use it from home. You can use it on a tablet, whether it be an FCC-issued tablet or not. You could use it on your phone in theory, but a Windows desktop on a phone is kind of hard to read. And the good thing is at the FCC, we are actually required to actually provide wireless in the building and because that's part of when people come to visit in the commission. Now, that is wireless that's not just for FCC employee use. It's actually for the public's use when they actually have the meetings at the FCC. And so in some respects, it's more like the Starbucks model, which is it's open and you trust the internet at your own risk. But that said, what we are doing with secure virtual desktop is it's a kernel. And so it's a secure kernel that's actually pointing back to us. And so regardless of whether you trust that connection or not, it's establishing a secure kernel to the FCC. Mm-hmm. And so what we're interested in as we begin to extend this model going forward is, are there other things we can do in that kernel that would give us, you know, a surety that only the things that are meant to be in that kernel are there, nothing's leaving that kernel. We also have the ability to collapse the kernel if somehow you say my device got stolen, it's missing, and so we can actually remove the data. And so it also helps us from a security standpoint because now I don't have 750 different desktops that are all vulnerable points. I really have an image of a desktop that is self-contained, again, within that kernel, that I have to focus on that image being secure, but not the 750 different desktops.
How is the FCC keeping a pace with transformative IT advances? We will ask David Bray, Chief Information Officer with the Federal Communications Commission, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour.